Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. A lot going on this week, obviously. I would love to not discuss this week's off-year elections, but, you know, it's a political podcast. I don't see that we have much choice. So we're going to speak with Paul Waldman about what happened and what it might portend for the next couple of years. Paul writes for the Washington Post. Then we're going to be joined by Philadelphia Inquirer columnist Will Bunch to talk about the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, the cop-loving teen who gunned down several Black Lives Matter protesters in Kenosha last year. But first, a lot of people are pointing out that critical race theory is not taught in schools. They don't teach CRT to K-12 students for the same reasons they don't teach particle physics or torts law. It's advanced, right? And others are kind of calling out gullible white people for falling for what is a pretty obvious right-wing propaganda campaign. Like, okay, take a listen to this guy from Virginia. He was interviewed by the Young Turks.
And what is critical race theory?
Well, I'm not going to get into the specifics of it because I don't understand it that much, but it's something that I don't, what little bit that I know, I don't care for.
And what have you heard that you don't,
well,
that you
I'm
don't
not,
like?
Well, I'm not going to, you know, I don't have that much knowledge on it, but okay. It's something that I'm not, that I don't care for.
And if you think that it's unfair of me to pick on a random guy on the street, here's Tucker Carlson of Fox News.
I've never figured out what a critical race theory is, to be totally honest, after a year of talking about it. They're teaching that some races are morally superior to others, that some are inherently sinful and some are inherently saintly, and that's immoral to teach that because it's wrong. That would be my view. Well, and I think also, most voters' view.
Of course, Tucker's characterization is utter nonsense. He is clearly correct that he's never figured out what it is. In simple terms, CRT is a graduate level study of how laws and public policies that are racially neutral on their face can be written with racially discriminatory intent and lead to racially discriminatory outcomes. So it's not, you know, I'm simplifying, but this is the crux of it. And maybe the classic example of this kind of analysis, or a classic example, is sentencing disparities related to cocaine, right? For many years, for 30 years until the Fair Sentencing Act was signed into law in 2010, people who were busted with crack cocaine faced much, much harsher penalties than those who were caught using or selling powdered cocaine. If you possess 5 grams of cocaine, you faced a 5-year minimum prison sentence. To get a similar sentence with powdered cocaine, though, you had to have at least 500 grams. So 100 times more to get the same prison sentence. Now, crack cocaine was disproportionately the cocaine product of choice among people of color. And white people who were arrested for using cocaine were more likely to be holding powdered cocaine. So there was never any law that said Black people would be given much harsher sentences for cocaine than white people, right? That was never, nobody ever wrote that down. But it had that effect for literally decades. And there are so many similar examples of this. You know, we'll talk about the Kyle Rittenhouse case with Will Bunch in a little bit. But the trial of the 3 white men charged with chasing down and killing Ahmaud Arbery, who was jogging in a suburban Georgia neighborhood, also started this week. And here's an interesting thing. The county where the killing occurred is a 25% African-American county, right? But only one of the 12 jurors hearing the case will be a Black person. And the defense, this is after the defense got 8 others dismissed. The Supreme Court has ruled that it's unconstitutional to strike a juror because of his or her race, right? And the judge, according to the New York Times, acknowledged that, and I quote, quite a few African-American jurors were excused through peremptory strikes executed by the defense. So he noticed that there was a trend here that would seem to go against the Constitution, but his hands were tied because all the defense had to do was articulate a minimally coherent reason for striking them. The judge noticed this, but couldn't do anything about it. So in 2021, a bunch of Southern white men who allegedly murdered a black man jogging through their neighborhood will be tried in front of an almost all-white jury. So, getting back to CRT, the propaganda is effective in part because it's difficult to argue that the critical race theory presented by Tucker Carlson and the rest of the right-wing media is 100% bullshit, but also that the real CRT is very important. Real CRT, real critical race theory, actual critical race theory, is important for law students and sociologists and law enforcement and legislators and others to study. It's actually good and important stuff. And with that, we'll take a quick break and then be right back with Paul Waldman. Stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm joined by Paul Waldman now, who writes for The Washington Post and The American Prospect. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time on a shitty day. I feel like losing is bad enough, but when Democrats lose specifically, we then have to wade through like a flood of lazy apocalyptic punditry for days on end. You hear about, you know, how this is a center-right country, and it's a double whammy. And I'm not sure that the GOP has the same problem when they lose. CNN has a piece up today titled "Donald Trump Fever May Be Breaking." It's by Zachary Wolf, and it features this remarkable passage. Let me quote it. "Here's one thing everybody can be happy about. The election results, for the most part, are not being questioned. That may have a lot to do with Republicans doing well. Maybe, who knows? But the results should prove to them that Trump's voter fraud myth is, in fact, a myth." The gap between like basic observation and this type of punditry is stunning to me. What can you even say about that?
I think that a lot of it is motivated by hope, perhaps.
Yeah.
But there's this, there is still a baseline kind of assumption that when Republicans do something crazy, no matter how many times they do it, or no matter how many absurd things they incorporate into their worldview, that it's sort of temporary. It's just an act for the rubes. And yeah, underneath it all, there is a sane party that in the right circumstances is just waiting to return. That's really not true. Or even if it is true in certain kinds of ways, it doesn't really matter. And I think that, you know, I've been seeing that in other places too. You know, Rich Lowry from the National Review has a piece up on Politico saying that, you know, this is a defeat for Donald Trump, because that's something that the people like him desperately want to be true, that Trump will just sort of fade into the woodwork and we'll have candidates like Glenn Youngkin who can benefit from Trumpism without being too Trumpy. Yeah. And, I really just don't think that that's true at all. I mean, obviously, Glenn Youngkin is in some ways a very traditional kind of Republican in that You know, what he did with critical race theory is very much like what, for instance, George H.W. Bush did with Willie Horton. You know, nobody really thought, even at in the heart of the 1988 campaign, that when he was president, Bush would spend a lot of time working on prison furlough policy. And right. Nobody really thinks that Glenn Youngkin is going to spend a lot of time on education policy, let alone on critical race theory. You know, there's a general acceptance that that is just an act for the rubes. And, you know, this is what people are angry about now. So he exploits it for a while. And then once he's in office, he will pursue the traditional Republican agenda of tax cuts and deregulation. Yeah. You know, in that sense, he does harken back to that previous era. But that doesn't mean that, you know, Trumpism is any less of a force within the Republican Party, or that, you know, things like the fact that someone like Youngkin wins means that there are going to be any less committed to the idea that a victory by Democrats can never be legitimate and is proof of voter fraud, for instance.
Right, exactly right. And there was talk about Youngkin running for president in 2024. You know, I think Republican primary voters, specifically primary voters across the country, don't want somebody like Youngkin. They want somebody like Trump, right? Or DeSantis or Abbott, as Florida Governor Ron DeSantis or Greg Abbott from Texas. Let's try to talk about what actually happened. You wrote, and I quote, one of the most pervasive biases among the political media is a bias towards dramatization, interpreting every event as startling, extraordinary, and signaling a reshaped political landscape. Paul, what is thermostatic public opinion?
Well, it's the idea that, like, you know, your thermostat, when it gets too hot, it turns on and cools things down, and vice versa. The idea is that the public is always kind of pulling the political system back to sort of something like the middle, that whenever there's a Democrat who becomes president, then the public immediately becomes a little more conservative. And when there's a Republican who's president, the public immediately becomes a little more liberal. And so there's always this kind of push and pull. But one of the, I think maybe the most important thing that happens whenever there's a change in the White House is that the opposition party gets very mad. And, you know, if you're a Democrat, you know, what's your view of how things are going? You know, even if things were going a little bit better for Joe Biden, you know, there are some problems here that also set a context for Virginia and New Jersey. Biden's approval ratings are low. There's inflation that we're dealing with, et cetera, et cetera. But even if, say, they had passed the infrastructure bill and the Build Back Better bill a couple of weeks ago, what would the average Democrat be saying about how things are going? They'd say, well, you know, pretty good. You know, this bill wasn't everything that I wanted, but it's going to do some good things. And we're not actually feeling those things because these policies take years to actually roll out. But, you know, looks like things are okay. And what is a Republican voter thinking? Well, they're in a rage. And they're going to be as long as there's a Democrat in the White House. Because every day they see this guy they hate in the newspapers and on television. Just as when Donald Trump was president, they Democrats were in a rage for 4 years. That's just how it works. And anger is the best motivator of political action, including voting. And that's always the way it's going to be. And so there was absolutely nothing that was unexpected about what happened on Tuesday. Of course, Republicans were going to get a big win. The opposition party always gets a big win. You know, I think 11 out of the last 12 elections in Virginia, gubernatorial elections, whichever party was in the White House lost. And interestingly, the one exception was when Terry McAuliffe himself won in 2013 when Barack Obama was president. But that year, he actually got a lower percentage of the vote than he did this year. But there was a Libertarian candidate who got 6%, and that helped him win.
Yeah.
So it's not like this was some kind of dramatic, unexpected thing. But as I wrote there, you know, reporters always have a tendency to want to make whatever they're writing about as kind of interesting and compelling as possible. And we tend to get this kind of blinkered view that whatever just happened has changed everything. And, you know, the alternative way of looking at it is to say, you know, if you look at things through a more historical perspective, it's actually not that unexpected, and it's not that surprising, not that dramatic. And, you know, saying that might be true, but it makes for kind of a boring story.
Yeah, it's not good for pundits, not good for punditry to just say, well, this is to be expected to a very great degree. You also wrote, here's the reality for 2022, only something truly earth-shaking will prevent the almost inevitable outcome of Democrats losing the House and probably the Senate as well. This is not doing well, by the way, for my long-term goal of not making this program overly depressing, right? You're not helping. You know, I wrote a piece for The Nation a while back arguing that there's good reason to believe that voters tend to punish the party in power just for doing stuff. And the exact stuff that they matter, that they do, doesn't really matter that much. And I urge Democrats to just go big if they get the opportunity, because then at least they can do something about, you know, climate and healthcare and improving people's material well-being before getting trounced or shellacked. So today, Axios has a headline reading, Biden hits the gas. The Washington Post, the news side, you're on the opinion side, has a report titled, After Loss in Virginia, Democrats Look to Speed Up Their Stalled $3 trillion Spending Agenda. Meanwhile, West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin is telling reporters that this was a signal that they should slow down. Paul, what are the chances that Dems don't panic and do take away what I think is the proper message that they better pass some good stuff? So they have not only so they have a better shot next year, but so that they pass some good stuff.
Well, that seems to be the prevailing wisdom from everyone except Manchin. I think there's an understanding that
I hate that guy.
You know, you can that passing these bills may not save them in 2022, but not passing them is certainly going to be a problem, because Democratic voters are quite reasonably going to say, what was the point of electing you people if you can't do anything? And then that will dampen Democratic turnout. I happen to think that it's all but inevitable that they're going to lose in 2022. So they should just do whatever they can to accomplish things, because that's what they supposedly entered politics for. You know, the problem is that, you know, you have this horribly messy process that you know, it reinforces all the things that people believe about Washington and how they can't get anything done. And it's all just a bunch of infighting. And then at the end of it, if it works, you get a day or two of good headlines about how you passed a bill. But because Democrats especially deal with all these very complicated policies, it usually takes a long time for them to play out to people's benefit. And the Affordable Care Act is a great example. You know, they worked for an entire year to get this incredibly intricate thing passed, and they managed to do it by the skin of their teeth. And then they lost hugely in the 2010 midterm elections anyway, just as Bill Clinton had lost in the 1994 midterms when he tried and failed to pass healthcare reform. Right. And what happened? Well, you know, within 10 years, it became a political advantage to Democrats. And when Republicans tried to undo it in 2018, they paid a very serious price.
Yeah.
But you know, it wasn't in the short term, it didn't do anything for them. They still had a terrible blowout in that first midterm election. And, you know, the truth is that barring some kind of extraordinary circumstances, that's probably going to happen to Democrats this year, too. So the answer is to just do the things you think are the right thing to do. And then at least at the end of it, you'll be able to say, you know, we did something meaningful for the country. You know, I think that's the problem with somebody like Manchin in particular, is that it's hard to tell what he actually wants in a substantive way. You know, he'll talk a lot about why the things Democrats want to do are too liberal, but he doesn't have much of a discernible agenda himself. But one of the interesting things, I think, is that you're hearing not just from the liberals in the party, but a lot of the those frontline members in the House, the more centrist members, who themselves are saying, we have to pass this because if we don't, I am really screwed in the midterms. Like those people who were in those swing districts, they know that, you know, they might, parts of the bill might be controversial. There are things that they want to do to make it a little more centrist. But if nothing passes, then there's going to be no reason for people in their districts to vote for them.
Yeah, that's right. Listen, I don't want to be Pollyannish, and I think that you're probably right. Next year is probably going to be bad for the Democrats. The most likely scenario is that they lose the House and the Senate. But I have to say that I'm feeling a bit humble in my predictive powers, because I'm not sure if like past historical patterns still apply or will apply in this kind of very different, you know, this post-Trump world, post-pandemic world, there's some reasons, I think, to think it's possible there'll be an alternative scenario, mostly that this is such a bad time to hold an election for Democrats. You know, we talked about Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and all the wrangling, months of wrangling, and uncertainty about the Democratic agenda even passing. But also during that same time, you know, we're at the tail end of a very big wave of COVID. You know, Glenn Youngkin did keep Trump kind of locked up. Next year, I think Trump is certainly going to be out doing rallies around the country. He's going to be a big part of it. Democrats, when they run against Trump in 2022, are going to have Trump out on the campaign, you know, on the campaign trail. And then I think Trump candidates, you know, he's going to endorse a lot of candidates who are extreme and who are personally loyal to him and who, you know, embrace the so-called big lie about voter fraud and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the idea that the out party always does well is based on the fact that they're, as you said, more fearful than the party in power. And I don't know, man, after January 6th, we'll see next year what it looks like. We could be past the pandemic by then. We could be seeing a real booming economy as pent up demand gets, you know, gets met with decent supply chains, et cetera, et cetera. I'm trying not to be fatalistic about it. I think it's likely that it'll be bad, but it could not be because things are very weird.
I think you've done a good job of laying out what the best case scenario for Democrats is, that the pandemic is fading, the economy is going really well, which would, you know, boost Joe Biden's approval ratings. And then if you add to that a more kind of daily in your face presence of Donald Trump, that will really be the best chance that they have, because there's never been somebody who motivates Democrats the way Trump does. And he uncharacteristically has remained very quiet. And, you know, maybe someone in the party, the Youngkin campaign, managed to convince him that this was the best way for them to succeed, was for him to be as quiet as possible. And, you know, I've always thought from the moment of the 2020 election that he was going to say that he would run again in 2024, or that he was toying with it just so people would keep paying attention to him, but then he wouldn't run. But, you know, I've kind of changed my view about that. I think chances are he probably will. You know, there's a certain amount of speculation in trying to figure out what's in Donald Trump's head, of course.
Sure.
But there's every day we get closer to the 2024 election, the more he's going to want to make himself a presence. And if in the 2022 campaign he is really in the news a lot and Democrats are feeling that, you know, he could return and that's a genuine threat, then that could be a great motivating factor for them to get to the polls. So I think that's the best chance. I mean, if you look back at the only two recent elections where the out party didn't win a huge victory in the midterms, the first was 1998, where there was a backlash to the impeachment of Bill Clinton. And the second was 2002, when we were still really in that post 9/11 thing. And George W. Bush had approval ratings in the mid 60s. And, you know, they successfully said that Democrats were terrorist loving traitors and all that.
Yeah.
So it's not that it's impossible, but you have to have something really monumental happening. And something monumental could happen. And maybe the potential return of Donald Trump to the White House, if it's really seeming like a real urgent possibility, could be monumental enough. It's always possible.
Yeah. One more before I let you go. Media critics today, including, you know, me, are pointing out that the kind of ubiquitous narrative that education played a central issue in this race is an irresponsible way to talk about a campaign that was built around stirring up white racial grievances about CRT when that is not a real issue. You wrote a piece about how the GOP has kind of ended up in a post-dog whistle place. They're no longer kind of trying to be subtle to avoid getting punished by the voters. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't think dog whistles are really possible anymore. You know, the idea of a dog whistle is that it's inaudible to the human ear, and political dog whistles are inaudible to certain people while there are sort of subsets of the electorate that you're speaking to who get the message. But now everybody gets the message. You know, you can't hide anything anymore. There's nothing to decode. you know, within moments of you saying something, it will be widely understood what you're talking about. And you have, you know, an extremely polarized electorate, and you have a Republican Party that doesn't want dog whistles. They want people who will be forthright in kind of the most offensive things that they want to say. And, you know, the education thing, this is one of the other interesting things that's happening right in the wake of this election. And I just wrote a piece that's going to go up soon on the Washington Post about this, is that, you know, the entire Republican Party has basically decided that this is like Captain America's super serum, that every single campaign up and down the ballot is all going to be about critical race theory and education. And of course, they don't have much of a governing agenda when it comes to education. You know, it's not like we're having a debate over should taxes go up or down. You know, they just want people to be mad and to, you know, say vague things like, oh, you know, parents ought to be in control, which doesn't actually tell you how policy might change. And furthermore, you know, the federal government has very little to do with how education runs in America. So the analogy I make is that, you know, having a member of Congress saying in their campaign that they're going to give parents back control over education is like, you know, your local city council person telling you they have a plan to contain North Korea's nuclear program. Right. It's just not where their authority is. Right. So they're all saying that this is the thing. This is, you know, where it's going to be for them from now through 2022. It's not actually, it might be an effective campaign issue, but, you know, who knows what it'll be like a year from now. But there's no question that the Republican Party thinks that this is the secret sauce that is really going to work for them.
Yeah, and Democrats can't just ignore it and hope that it goes away. That's clearly the case. I brought this up before. It used to be that political scientists would find that there was a penalty to be paid by appealing to white racial grievance in too explicit a way, that voters would punish those people. And somewhere along the way, that effect stopped being apparent. And that was in the 2010, 2011, around then, after the election of Barack Obama, the first black president. So we attribute all of this to Trump. But we should attribute a lot of this to Barack Obama and the backlash against his presidency. Paul Waldman, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really do appreciate it.
My pleasure. I'm always happy to join you.
Folks, stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then be right back with Will Bunch.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line. I find it very, very easy to be true. I find myself alone when each day's through. Yes, I'll admit that I'm a fool for you. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland. You know, I honestly can't believe that I have not had my next guest on the show before. I thought that I had. Will Bunch is a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We followed each other on Twitter for years now, and I don't know why we haven't connected previously. He's a really smart guy. I am happy to finally have him on. Will Bunch, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Joshua, thanks so much for having me. It's great to finally meet you.
Yeah, finally, right?
In some other venue that where we can talk in more than 280 characters. Right?
It's weird. We're going to have you on now that we're in contact off of Twitter. We're going to have you on more often. So the murder trial of Kyle Rittenhouse began this week. It has gotten off to a rough start. Rittenhouse, as I'm sure all listeners know, was the teenager who traveled to Kenosha, Wisconsin during the protests over a police officer shooting Jacob Blake in the back 7 times in front of his children. And he killed 2 people and wounded a third with an AR-15. Then he went home. Wasn't even detained by the police there. Some jurors said that they were fearful of sitting on the jury. And the judge in this case has raised some eyebrows. He had previously ruled that evidence of Rittenhouse sucker punching a young woman at an earlier protest was inadmissible, but he ruled that video of cops thanking Rittenhouse for being there prior to the murders was admissible. And then this week he ruled that while Rittenhouse's victims could not be referred to as such in court, can't call them victims, they could be called looters and rioters. Will had an alarming column about this. It's titled, When Do We Get to Use the Guns, the Life or Death Stakes of the Kyle Rittenhouse Trial? You can read it at Inquirer.com. Will, was there any evidence presented that Rittenhouse's victims were, in fact, rioting or looting? It's hard for me to wrap my head around a judge saying that attorneys can't call them victims, but can call them these, like, extremely volatile, you know, descriptors.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a great question. You know, Rittenhouse was part of this posse of folks who organized themselves online, basically, which is, you know, one of the bad things about the internet, right? That it makes it easier to organize a posse if you are so inclined. And then 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse, who was kind of a cop and gun enthusiast, was so inclined. So, I mean, what his defense is going to present this week or next week in terms of their self-defense argument is, you know, they're going to show footage of these altercations. And the thing is, these vigilantes, went to Kenosha spoiling for a fight, right? And yes. So they got one, you know, and they confronted people who were out there protesting in their various ways for racial justice. And, you know, as these scuffles ensued, I mean, a lot of the violence they're alleging happened after the first encounter where Rittenhouse had already shot and killed one man. So, I mean, I think normally your application would be, this guy just killed somebody, stop him, you know, do something. And so, yeah, there were more altercations and a guy swung his skateboard at Kyle Rittenhouse, and his defense is trying to show that a skateboard could be a deadly weapon, that I think they found one case in human history where somebody was, like, decapitated or something by a skateboard. So they're going to argue this, but I mean, you know, as much as his individual defense may or may not be about self-defense, I mean, what's really on trial here is the whole notion of, you know, vigilante justice, and which is wrapped into just the growing, you know, zeitgeist on the political far right now, which is that we're in a situation that calls for violence. You know, that you know, we need guns, and you know, we should be ready to use them, because, you know, in the last year or so, this has all been wrapped up with phony conspiracy theories. So, you know, we're going to need guns because now the Democrats are stealing all the elections.
I mean, that goes back a lot longer than the last year or two. I mean, it used to be black helicopters, UN helicopters back in the 90s. You know, we had the kind of Ruby Ridge militia movement 1.0.
I mean, I would highly recommend people check out a book by Kathleen Ballou called Bringing the War Home, which, you know, traces this whole movement back to the end of the Vietnam War in the late 70s. All the way through, and she talks about this. But you know, I think right now, with the kind of Trump inspired or post Trump conspiracy theories, either about stolen elections or of course, all, you know, all the paranoia surrounding COVID and vaccines and masks and whatnot, it's just a growing climate of conversations about violence and then actual violence, including,
for sure. Let's before we get into the kind of bigger context, you took a look at the judge who is hearing this case, a guy named Bruce Schroeder, and his background. Again, we're going to get to the larger context, but before we do, what did you find out about this judge?
Yeah, well, speaking of the 1980s, as we have been, this is a judge who was appointed back in 1984. And he is so much of that era, right? The era that elected Ronald Reagan, the Law and Order era. And he's kind of a loose cannon, but always really tough on defendants, always mocking civil liberties kind of judge. You know, I mean, the first time he ever made any kind of headline outside of Kenosha was, that sex workers would be required to get AIDS tests. And when they said, well, that might be a civil liberties violation, he said, I don't care about civil liberties, basically. And he's kind of proved that with his record. I mean, very recently, flash forward 35 years, and there was a case where the appeals court in Wisconsin accused Judge Schroeder of public shaming a defendant in his court who was convicted of retail theft. And he said, well, as part of your sentence, if you enter a store, in the near future, you're going to have to go to the management of that store and tell them that you have a criminal record for retail theft. He was so, his reputation in Kenosha was so bad that the newspaper actually did this article in 2006 that said there was now a huge backlog in the county court system because so many defendants had requested not to have him as their judge. You know, we're trying to find ways not to go before Judge Schroeder. So, you mentioned some of his rulings now in the Kyle Rittenhouse case, which are becoming very controversial. And yeah. And this is all one piece with his record. He just seems like this case is going to have such national implications depending on how it goes. And he's not the guy you really want to be overseeing this trial.
Yeah, it feels like the fix is in, and we will have to see how it shakes out. Obviously, keep in mind that prosecutors cannot appeal an acquittal, and also keep in mind that this Justice Department under Merrick Garland has been extremely wary of getting involved in any kind of politically charged cases. So it's unlikely that you would see a civil rights prosecution, any kind of federal movement on this if Rittenhouse gets off. And you connect this case to, as we started to talk about, this kind of continually growing amount of violent eliminationist rhetoric on the right. And in the column, you mentioned this viral video from a Trump supporter at a Turning Point USA conference. Turning Point USA is a right-wing campus youth group led by Charlie Kirk. You might have heard this. Again, it was all over Twitter and Facebook. But let's just take a quick listen to this clip.
Fascism. This is tyranny. When do we get to use the guns? No, and I'm not, that's not a joke. I'm not saying it like that. I mean, literally, where's the line? How many elections are they going to steal before we kill these people?
So, hold on. Now, I'm going to denounce that. I'm going to tell you why. Because you're playing into all their plans, and they're trying to make you do this.
So people in that audience cheered. Kirk pushed back on that. Charlie Kirk, the co-founder of TPUSA, pushed back on that. And you thought that the way he did so was kind of revealing. What did he find problematic with that question?
Yeah, I mean, he said, I'm going to disagree with you, but he didn't say, I'm shocked you would say that, or this is your idea so immoral or anything like that. What he said was, you're giving the left ammunition, pun half intended, but you're giving the left reasons to crack down on us, and we don't want that. So, he viewed it in context of the great game with the evil far left, right? That was Charlie Kirk's perspective.
It's becoming kind of mainstream. There was a survey just released this week by the Public Religion Research Institute, PRRI, found that 30% of Republicans believe that, and I quote, true American patriots may need to resort to violence in order to save the U.S. That was true of 11% of Democrats as well. So we're all charged up, but 30% of Republicans. It's a a third believe that we may have to resort to violence. And there has actually been an enormous amount of political violence from the right over the past several years, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, what's really bizarre about the whole Turning Point USA incident from last week and this guy's comments. So this meeting with Charlie Kirk took place in Boise, Idaho, right? Which is the biggest city in Idaho. I don't know if people were even aware, or maybe they were, maybe they weren't. I guess maybe it didn't really matter to them. But that exact same day, I think it actually happened an hour or two earlier than the meeting, but that same day also in Boise, Idaho, you had this thing, and I'm still flabbergasted that this thing barely cracked the national news at all. I don't know if I saw it at all on the national news, but there was a mall shooter in Boise. In fact, he went to the state's largest mall, with a gun, and he shot seven people. he killed two of the people that he shot. One was a immigrant from Mexico, and the other was a security guard at the mall who was part of the transgender community there. So it was interesting targets, and so you would suspect that maybe this guy had a far right background, and he did. You know, his online profile had all sorts of, you know, hate speech toward Latinos and other groups. He was a Second Amendment fanatic. He'd been having this running battle with the governor over his own gun rights because he had a criminal record, and there were restrictions on his ability to own a gun, and he was up in arms about that. I mean, this guy was a far right extremist, you know. So on the same day that you have this guy asking when do we get to use the guns, this guy from the far right was in a mall using the guns, or using a gun. So I'm kind of shocked it didn't get more national coverage. Like I said, David Nywert. I never hear his name out loud, so I wasn't sure how to pronounce it, even though I've been reading him for about 20 years. who's a great chronicler of far right extremist movements, especially out west where he lives. He really pieced together the whole history of this guy, and also he'd been at some event where there were leftist or maybe Antifa or whatever protesters, and he'd been menacing them with his gun at that event. This is far from the only shooting or murder that we can tie to right wing extremism. You know, there's Dylan Roof, there's the El Paso Walmart shooter, to just to name two of the most egregious cases. And there was
a civil suit against the organizers of the Unite the Right protest in Charlottesville in 2017 that started this week as well. There was Cesar Sayoc, the so-called MAGA bomber who sent pipe bombs to Donald Trump's perceived enemies. There was, of course, the Capitol riot. And everybody who watches Fox believes that it is the left that is responsible for political violence and that entire cities have been burned down. It's remarkable. The projection is incredible.
They've got a few clips from the 2020 racial protest that they have on a loop that they just play constantly, no matter what the story is, you know, without any context or relation. But, you know, I mean, that works. I engage with my conservative readers all the time, and that may be their biggest complaint. You know, what about them burning down the cities in 2020?
That's their whataboutism when it comes to the Capitol riot. They say, well, exactly. What about all the cities that burned down? And when you tell them, look, there were no cities that burned down, what the fuck are you talking about? They think that you're nuts, right? Because they hear it every day from the conservative press.
They see it on Fox every night on, you know, Tucker Carlson or whatever. Yeah. You see those same clips over and over again.
The same trash. Yeah, like there's a dumpster, literally a dumpster on fire.
They'll be talking about Minneapolis, but they'll find a dumpster fire from Portland and they'll show that, you know, and I think Newsmax
got caught doing they were running footage from a riot in Ukraine.
Oh yeah. I heard about that.
Somewhere like that, maybe Ukraine or somewhere. But yeah, it wasn't even in this country.
Yeah, why limit yourself to the United States, right?
Yeah, no, there's juicy footage of chaos elsewhere.
Yeah.
So you're connecting this in the in your piece, which I urge everybody to read. You connect this trial in Wisconsin with all this violent rhetoric and actual violence, and warn that an acquittal for Kyle Rittenhouse could have, you know, serious consequences. Can you talk about what you see as the stakes here?
Yeah, I mean, I think as the Trump-fried political movement, you know, embraces violence more and more. I mean, they're looking for heroes, they're looking for martyrs. You know, another martyr to this group is Ashley Babbitt, the woman who was shot and killed during the Capitol riot, during the insurrection, who's been praised in a video by Trump himself. And you know, Rittenhouse already obviously has a lot of high-profile supporters on the right. I mean, they raised $2 million to bail him out of jail, which is why he's been free and hanging out with the Proud Boys while he's waiting for a double murder trial, which is kind of hard to believe. But
yes,
only in America, or only in a certain corner of America, anyway. But you know, if he is found not guilty of, you know, by reasons of self-defense, which is his defense, if he's found now not guilty, I think many people in that community, that extremist right-wing community, are going to see this basically as, you know, license to kill. I know that's a, you know, that's a loaded term from a James Bond movie, perhaps, but, you know, basically, you know, why can't we then go to left-wing protests or whatever, you know, with large numbers of people with guns, because, you know, we're protecting the public, and now we have legal precedent on our side. You know, I mean, it's not really legal precedent. It would be one judge's ruling in one case, but in the hothouse environment of the internet, I mean, it would be portrayed as a victory for you know, civil war type politics. You know. And so this is happening at the worst possible time. I mean, I couldn't think of, you know, I mean, to have this trial right when this violent mood on the far right is kind of reaching a crescendo, is, you know, the timing couldn't be worse. So
yeah, it's getting very dangerous out there. There was an excellent piece in the Boston Globe this week. Also this week, lots of stuff at the same time. They looked at all these incidents where people had attacked protesters, mostly anti-racist protesters, with cars. Scores of people have been hit by cars during these protests, resulting in dozens of injuries. Quote, at least three deaths, but precious little justice, much less sympathy for the demonstrators injured, killed, or just plain terrified. Oklahoma and 15 other states have considered bills protecting drivers, not protesters, as these ramming incidents have proliferated. So check that out too. It's a frightening trend.
Right, it's the flip side of Judge Schroeder. Right, it's people with power giving permission for these kind of attacks. Yeah. Absolutely.
Call it fascism, God. Call it fascism. That's what it is. Folks, as you know, I've been trying to avoid being too depressing, and I just want to apologize for this week's entire show. Everything is awful right now, and Will certainly did not help us stay positive. But a lot can happen in a year, right? We may be approaching the end of the pandemic.
I tend to have that effect on people for some reason.
Will, I want to thank you for joining us, and let's have you on again, hopefully, when we can discuss something a little bit more encouraging.
Absolutely. Or any time, really. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me, Joshua.
Thanks so much. I also want to thank Paul Waldman and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. I'd like to thank the good folks at Alternet and Raw Story for supporting the show. And of course, I would like to thank all of you fine people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.
cha-cha dance de bolero in a sombrero shade like a snake. You wanna stop the world because you're up to the right for two big moves to the big, big, big is ever getting in a lesson. Go the platter that rocks the jukebox. I'm telling you,